Brian Lehrer with you on WNYC from the Green Space today. By the way, we'll be in the Green Space one more time before the election, the fourth of this four-part series of live events, with Bill Moyers as my guest for the full 2 hours here next Friday. We'll have some other people, too, yet to be determined who we'll build around Bill Moyers with. But those of you listening on the radio, go to wnyc.org/thegreenspace. Because there are still some tickets available left for next Friday morning here at 10 o'clock. Our next guest is MSNBC's Joyanne Reed, host of AM Joy on weekend mornings from 10 a.m. to noon. Nice slot, 10 a.m.
Yeah.
to noon. She's also on during the weekdays a lot as a correspondent, analyst, and commentator. Joy Reed is pretty well experienced to be a national political commentator, if I've got her bio right. She was born in Brooklyn to immigrants from two different countries,
yes.
Then raised mostly in Denver, mm-hmm. Went to college at Harvard, and then worked in journalism and politics in Miami before going to MSNBC.
Only and, swing states. I only live in swing
except New York.
Except
and she's the author of Fracture, Barack Obama, the Clintons, and the Racial Divide, which came out last year. Please welcome Joyanne Reed to Green Space. So let me begin, if I may, with the Miami Joy Reed. Relevant to today, I read that you were a press aide to the Obama campaign in Florida in 2008. Did you do that?
I did, yeah. I had, for a while, I got out of news. I actually got out of news in 2003. I was very opposed to the Iraq War, and I just didn't feel good about the way that we in media were kind of rooting for it in a lot of ways. So I wrote a column for the Miami Herald sort of expressing that belief, which was not a popular thing to do if you're working in news. So I just decided it was best to just get out. So I worked on the 2004 campaign, made a lot of contacts. I actually worked outside with a 527, one of those evil George Soros 527s, trying to help John Kerry. And then in 2008, some of my friends from that 2004 campaign came back to me. They were working on the Obama campaign. They needed some help in Florida, so I signed on for the tail end of that campaign.
So through the lens of that experience and Florida being absolutely critical yet again this year, how do you see Clinton compared to Trump in terms of the ground game to get out their votes?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, on my way over here, because I am that nerdy, I was actually texting with my former boss that I worked for, Steve Shale, on those campaigns. And we were looking at, because he puts out every day kind of what the early vote looks like. And it's very close. Republicans tend to win the absentee ballot chase in Florida because Republican voters tend to be older and more rural, more northern Florida. So they are ahead in absentee. Democrats are slightly ahead in in-person early vote, and Democrats tend to do better in in-person early vote. But they're not better by that much. It's very close. Right now, the electorate is looking about 40% Republican, 40% Democrat, and the remainder independent, when in reality, it's really about, you know, slightly more Democrats registered than Republicans.
That
so it's not
mean,
that great.
That doesn't mean, to be clear to the listeners, that 20% are voting for third-party candidates.
No.
That's just their party registration,
right?
Which is all you can tell about these early votes.
That's right. All you can tell is that, you know, Republicans are slightly ahead in terms of the Republicans who vote. But Florida's a weird state, too, because north of Orlando, a Democrat is a Republican. So somebody who calls themselves a Democrat still votes for Republicans, particularly for president. There's still a Dixiecrat sort of vibe in northern Florida.
I guess I'm amazed that the Florida polls are as close as they are. I mean, younger Cubans are trending Democratic. Puerto Ricans, Dominicans, Haitians, and retired Jews from Long Island are all pretty reliably Democratic. And I've heard that about half the voters in Florida are women. Have you heard that?
Yes.
So why is it even close?
Because Florida is basically two states. It's kind of Brooklyn on the bottom. It's like New York on the bottom and Alabama on the top. And that's just the way it is. Florida has a whole half of the state plus the panhandle that is really not that much different than South Carolina or Alabama. And there's a large contingent of the state that are hardcore conservative. So the way you think about Florida is that the three counties in the south are the north. And the rest of the state is sort of the South, and then the center is kind of Chicago, right? So it's got this Midwestern middle that is the swing part of the state, the Tampa, St. Pete area, that's like the Chicago middle. So it's a weird state. It's a difficult state. It's also an expensive state. The thing that surprises me, because Trump has no money and no organization, really no ground game, the fact that they are doing this well without any resources in a state with 10 media markets, 10. And Miami's not even the biggest one. Tampa is.
Wow.
It's an incredibly expensive state. I think it costs about $4 million a day to advertise statewide.
Now, listeners, if you have a question for Joy Reid, you can call in 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And those of you here in the green space, if you have a question, you can raise your hand and a producer will come around with a microphone. So how amazed and dismayed are you beyond Florida that the bottom hasn't totally dropped out of Trump support in general, with all the ways that he seems offensive and psychologically unfit and everything else to so many people we know? Is it amazing, dismaying, scary to you for the future that it's being revealed that someone like him has a floor in this country of about 40% of the electorate?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't surprise me, to be honest with you. Everything about this election is dismaying. Let's just, you know, stipulate that this has been probably the most dispiriting election ever. And it is in large part because Donald Trump is sort of a successful George Wallace. And I think George Wallace did so poorly in 1964 that Americans kind of created an illusion for ourselves that we are not the kind of country that would elect someone like George Wallace. Well, in a lot of ways, Donald Trump is very much George Wallace. He has the same sort of charismatic appeal to the working man that tells it like it is, every guy who's saying, you know, the elites look down on you, but I'm going to be your champion. That was the same message George Wallace had, with this heavy dose of ethnic nationalism, of white nationalism, quite frankly, that he's introduced into the body politic. And, you know, surprise, that is the country that we are. And I always tell people that you have to understand, when you look at Donald Trump, there are three things you have to remember. Number one is that Republicans exist. And any Republican, right, any Republican is going to get 40 to 45% of the vote. You get that just by being the Republican. So no matter who had gotten the nomination, they'd get 40 to 45% for free without doing anything. The second thing is that part of Trump's appeal is the fact that he is so countercultural, that he is normalizing things like blasting away political correctness, meaning impoliteness itself is the point, and that there's a large constituency for that. There are a lot of people who want that. And the third thing is that white America is really very divided between white Americans who have a college degree and those who don't. And white Americans without a college degree have a very, very fundamentally different political fundamental desire of what they want in a politician that may not even be understandable to a lot of white Americans with a college degree, which is why white Americans with a college degree are starting to trend the way that people of color trend, which is away from the Republican Party.
And yet your book is Fracture: Barack Obama, the Clintons, and the Racial Divide. And it's a 50-year look at the tension in the Democratic Party, for people who don't know, over how much to embrace or run away from the legacy of Lyndon Johnson. What aspects of his legacy most importantly?
Civil rights. You know, you have to understand that, you know, Lyndon Johnson grew up as a segregationist in the South, in Texas. He was one of the only Southerners, if not the only Southerner, to vote against the Southern Manifesto in 1957, which was the reaction against Brown v. Board, where 19 Southern senators said that they would oppose integration by any means necessary, wrote that down and signed it, which was not even controversial in the South at that time. Lyndon Johnson saw ahead that this was not the future for the party, but he made a decision that disrupted a 40-year coalition which had existed from the New Deal right up until that point between African Americans, Northern ethnic whites, Catholics and Jewish Americans, and segregationist racists. This, you know, I kind of think of it as a floating body that has existed in our politics from the very beginning, a revanchist faction that is racially revanchist. They do not believe in integration. They do not believe in full equality of all people. And they've just sort of floated and bounced back and forth between the two parties. At one point, they were kicked out of the Democratic Party and became the Dixiecrats, and they came back in. Then they were George Wallace Democrats, and they were kicked out again, and he formed this American Freedom Party, Independence Party, which still exists. Trump is on the ballot on that party in California. Huh. And they just sort of bounced back and forth between the parties. But the Democrats had custody of them for most of this country's history. history. And Democrats, finally, by 68, just kicked them out. And Republicans adopted them. So this is a faction that just exists, and each party has had to deal with them.
And so you say things like it was Bill Clinton who spearheaded a rightward shift because of the electoral consequences of embracing so much social change. You say, for example, the ways in which Bill Clinton rejected Jesse Jackson in 1992 reset the Democratic Party with the white working class.
Yeah, and it wasn't just Bill Clinton. A lot of people forget that Jimmy Carter was the conservative candidate. He was not a liberal by any stretch of the imagination.
In the Democratic primary field that
Absolutely,
year.
As a primary. And remember, George Wallace had come back into the party. So he was had an eye on George Wallace. He wanted to make sure he didn't lose voters to Wallace. And he was a Southern Baptist who wanted to remake the Democratic Party as less liberal and libertine to voters who felt that the party had gone too far, that Johnson had swung too far to the left. And so, you know, the book basically talks about this 50-year project to push away the legacy of Lyndon Johnson, not just the Vietnam part, but the part that made the Democratic Party seem too culturally liberal for a lot of white voters. And so you had Jimmy Carter pushed to the right, and then you had Bill Clinton really figure out this formula for keeping black voters voting Democratic while also pulling in white working class voters who were uncomfortable with the sort of hippie new party.
Now, I see that your description of yourself on Twitter is professional pragmatist, sunny pessimist. That's the real Joy Reid, right?
Yes.
Okay. I think both Bill and Hillary Clinton would argue that they are professional, progressive pragmatists trying to move the country forward, not backward, in social change terms, including racial justice, very conscious, very woke in their hearts. But what's the point of sounding pure if your election is going to turn out like McGovern or Mondale? Mm-hmm. Is that description too easy on them in your view?
It's a little too easy. I mean, look, the reality is Hillary Clinton went into college as a Goldwater conservative and came out as a McGovern liberal, right? So she was a right-winger as a teenager. And then she became an older teenager and a young woman and became quite liberal. But she also really understood pragmatic politics, and she's very smart about how you functionally get things done. And I think she's an admirer of Lyndon Johnson because Lyndon Johnson didn't make it pretty. He just got it done, right? It was nothing pretty about the way he passed the Civil Rights Act. I mean, he did things like tell African-American leaders to go to Republicans in Illinois and say, we will give you votes for Everett Dirksen to be reelected as the Republican if you will sign on to the Civil Rights Bill. So like, he's selling out his own party. So Hillary Clinton, I think, has the LBJ pragmatism. Bill Clinton is a white Southern man. He understands how the real world works. He doesn't have a sort of sunshiny, rose-colored glasses view of what people are like. He understands, having grown up in a segregated context, that if you want to win over white working class people, all this talk of anti-racism and safe spaces and political correctness, that isn't going to work. And so I think that they are pragmatists in the sense that they understand the real world. And so that can look cynical and it can look kind of icy to people, but it's very effective. What Bill Clinton has that Hillary Clinton doesn't is that he wraps all that up in warm Bubba veneer, and he has this charm that kind of covers that up, whereas Hillary Clinton is just a pragmatic person, and she comes across that way. And as women, we don't get to come across that way.
Now, you happen to come here on the day after Michelle Obama gave maybe her warmest and most ecstatic campaign appearance for Hillary Clinton. Here's 30 seconds for our audience to hear of Michelle Obama yesterday in Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
Yeah, that's right. Hillary doesn't play. She has more experience and exposure to the presidency than any candidate in our lifetime. Yes, more than Barack, more than Bill. So she is absolutely ready to be commander-in-chief on day one. And yes, she happens to be a woman.
So Michelle Obama yesterday, and having written a book about the Obamas and Clintons called Fracture, how much might a next edition be retitled Fracture Healed?
Yeah, no, it is. It is a huge heal because you have to remember, people forget how divisive the 2008 campaign was. This was the supposed first black president against the real potential first black president. It threw the Clintons completely off. They didn't even know how to run against black people. Bill Clinton had spent his whole life running with black people and having them behind him, even when he spurned Jesse Jackson in Jesse Jackson's own house. He still could keep the black votes. They didn't know what to do. And they were discombobulated, and some of Bill Clinton's the bad side of being a white Southern guy came out of them, right? And they had some problems. So for these two political families to get together in the way they have is a sign, number one, of how much they both detest Donald Trump, how much they believe that Barack Obama and Bill Clinton's legacies depend on not having that person become the president of the United States, and how much they've been able to negotiate a true peace between the families, because it wasn't easy, particularly between the former president and the current president. I mean, there was real bitterness there, and it's not 100% clear what their relationship is now, but Michelle Obama, I like to think of, my favorite movie is The Wiz of all time. I love The Wiz. And I think of Michelle Obama as Lena Horne at the end, where she's got that fairy dust and the magic and the babies are flying around her. She is magical. She has a magic wand, and she can touch anybody she wants with it. She touched Barack Obama with it in 2008 when even black people doubted that he was black enough to be the first black president. She just touched him, and black women in particular said, oh, my God, she's like me. She's like my sister, mother, friend. She reminds me of my cousin. I can relate to her. I like Barack Obama. And she literally touched him with this magic wand, and now she's decided to take her fairy magic and sprinkle it on Hillary Clinton. And Hillary's got to be so grateful, because it's really helping her.
You said that the Clinton and Obama presidential legacies are at stake in this election. But I've heard you frame a central question for a Hillary Clinton presidency, which is how much she's going to be a Clinton restoration candidate and how much an Obama continuation candidate. How much do you feel like you can answer that question based on the campaign?
I think the irony of Hillary Clinton's position is having been, you know, the wife of Bill Clinton and the essentially the staffer of Barack Obama, is that there's the only thing left of the Clinton legacy that she can embrace. All the rest is gone. Barack Obama's presidency has been a complete repudiation of Clintonism, repudiation on Don't Ask, Don't Tell, repudiation on DOMA, everything to do with gay rights, gone. The idea of mass incarceration in the crime bill, gone, and they can't even own it. They have to apologize for it. They've walked back nearly everything about Clintonism except one thing, which is the economic revival piece of it and what Bill Clinton could do for white working class people and black working class and Hispanic working class people, right? What he can do to uplift people economically is all that's left of the Bill Clinton legacy that's valuable to Hillary Clinton. So what she would have to do as president, which is a very difficult tightrope, is that she has to be a 100% Obama Democrat. That's how she wins, because she needs people of color, she needs young people, she needs Obama Democrats to win. She can't really be a Clinton Democrat. But when she gets in there, the thing that she could do that would be the most valuable to the party long term, if they want to really vanquish Republicans, is to win back the winnable portion of white working class voters who are still at least open to an argument that Democratic policies are better. And the person, ironically, who may have helped the most is Donald Trump. Donald Trump has exploded the myth that working class white voters want to end entitlements. They do not. They want entitlements. They have no interest in tax cuts for the rich. All of these things that the right has sold them, they didn't really ever buy them. They want cultural ascendancy, but they don't necessarily want, you know, to change the capital gains tax rate. They don't care about that. And I think that he having exposed that gives her an opening. If she can use Bill Clinton when she's, you know, assuming she wins, if she can use Bill Clinton to try to work on that particular demographic, that is where he could help her.
Fascinating. With us here in the Green Space, Joy Reid from MSNBC. And I think we have a question from the audience right over here. Sir.
Hi. I greatly enjoyed seeing you with Stephanie Miller. And watching the Democratic Party evolve was a very fascinating thing. Can you comment on how the GOP will evolve after the election?
Yeah. So the Republican Party has a problem, which is that it is very popular with a shrinking demographic. White America is not growing as fast as non-white America. Every year, every 4 years, this country becomes 2% more non-white. And so the electorate that elected Ronald Reagan just does not exist anymore. An 80% white electorate just doesn't exist. So to win elections, they cannot win with less than 40% of Hispanic votes. And you have to remember, Hispanics only vote at half their strength right now. Half their strength. They're 15% of the country. They vote. They're about 7% of the electorate. So if they even increased their voting, you know, behavior by 25%, they would wash out every Republican in the country. They just aren't using their own strength, whereas African Americans pretty much are. We're voting at like 70-something percent. So I think the Republican Party has a choice that it's going to have to make. It's reached this fork in the road before. It reached it in 08. It reached it in 12. Do you change your policies so as to appeal to white, to black, Hispanic, and Asian American voters who are growing in number? Or do you triple down on white voters, meaning that right now Donald Trump needs about 61-62% of the white vote to win? By 2020, you're going to need like 65%. The only person who's done that is Ronald Reagan. He got 66, but only once in his reelect. So it becomes impossible for the party to survive as more than just a congressional party if they don't change. I suspect they won't be able to change, though, because Republicans are so dependent on Trump-style voters. This type of voter runs the party now. There's too many of them. And unless they kick them out, and then they'll be so tiny that they won't be able to win either. So I've talked to Republican friends that are strategists who are very dismayed because they worry that even after this election, House Republicans and Senate Republicans are still going to be eyeing those Trump voters for their reelects. They're going to be so afraid of them that they're going to stay on this Trump track and they won't be able to get out of it. So I've definitely heard talk of that party splitting in two, of more moderate Republicans actually leaving the House. Like, the House is overrun by zombies. We're just going to leave and let the zombies have it and just moving on. I've heard real talk about whether they might start another party. I don't know if it's even practical, but I have heard talk of it.
So Republicans are going to need Hispanic voters. And I want to play a minute of you on MSNBC that I happen to be watching when you were hosting that made my jaw drop. And then it did get a little flurry of press coverage. Maybe you've already figured out what this is.
I know.
This was just last month, and your guests were our own likely next congressman from Upper Manhattan, succeeding Charles Rangel, Adriano Espaillat, and Marco Gutierrez, founder of the group Latinos for Trump. It might be the only time I have ever seen you left speechless when Gutierrez, who is Mexican-American, warned of the dangers of Mexican immigration.
We need to understand that this is a different time, and we're having problems here.
What problems are you talking about?
My culture is a very dominant culture, and it's imposing and it's causing problems. If you don't do something about it, you're going to have taco trucks every corner.
Wait a minute. I'm sorry. Hold on a second. I have to let Adriano in here.
I don't even know
what that means, and I'm almost afraid to ask.
I'm offended.
I'll tell you what that means. The Spanish never conquered Mexico.
The Spanish never conquered Mexico. My culture is a very dominant culture. He was like racist against himself. What did you even think when you heard that?
As you can see, I did not have a coherent response to that, because that's... I've never heard anything like that. If I had really thought it through, I would have said, well, that sounds delicious, because I love tacos, and I would love for that to happen. A taco truck on every corner would be fabulous.
Plus, I was standing in my kitchen doing the dishes when I happened to see that.
Yeah.
And yes, I have a television in my kitchen. But the and I thought, wait, this is a country where we have a pizza place on every corner.
That's right.
We didn't
Starbucks.
Have that in 1810.
Yeah.
We have a bagel store on every corner. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
This is America.
It is. And it's, you know, that's entrepreneurship. It's interesting. I actually ran into Marco Gutierrez when we were in Las Vegas. He turned up at our setup. And I had a lovely conversation with him. We took a photo together. And he even said that he thinks the good thing that came out of it is that it's encouraging people to, you know, create taco trucks, entrepreneurship and everything. But the thing that's and he also was kicked out of his own group. The guys that were with him in Latinos for Trump dumped him after that. And
he's sort of
a lonely figure
now.
They did dump him. I was wondering about that. Yeah, they did.
So they did find something that was too offensive for
Trump supporter.
It was
too offensive for them. But the thing that's sort of ironic about that is Marco Gutierrez was a recipient of amnesty when he was a kid from Ronald Reagan. The big amnesty. He was a recipient of it.
That Reagan called amnesty and embraced that word. We played that clip recently.
Absolutely. He received it. And there is this phenomenon, being the child of immigrants myself, there is a phenomenon among some immigrants of having an extra harsh view of other immigrants. The process to get into this country is incredibly laborious and difficult. My mother sponsored in her brothers and other family members, and it's really a difficult process. And so you have a lot of but there are some immigrants who resent other immigrants who they feel jump the line. And so there is this super conservatism. You see it among Cuban Americans who don't even go through the immigration process, that are very hardline against other immigrants. That's changing among Hispanics, but there still is that phenomenon.
Before you go, How do you like doing cable television for a living? It's a pretty hot and polarized part of the media.
It is. I came, as I sort of described, I worked in TV, but on the digital side. And then I did radio, as you do. And I love radio because you have that immediacy. You can talk back to the audience. It's great. So I'm in a lot of ways a radio person who does TV, or more of a writer who does TV. But I am enjoying doing this show. And I guess the reason is because I feel like this election has been so toxic that we come at the end of the week when we can kind of let the toxicity out of the system.
On your weekend show.
On the weekend show. We can have a little bit of fun. We can try to have some camaraderie and just make people feel a little bit better about it, explain it a little bit. So this is, I think, an important time to be doing this job because, I mean, people come up to me on the street who are completely flummoxed by this election, and the opportunity to kind of make it make sense for people is actually quite a privilege.
And
so
you're a person
it.
With strong opinions, obviously, and that's great. But do you ever feel ambivalent about contributing to this environment in which so many Americans lock themselves in their media echo chambers and don't listen to people politically different from themselves?
It's bad, and it is a problem. It's one of the reasons we are two countries. We're two countries that don't even really get along. I'm not sure we would sign a peace treaty with each other. And we don't even listen to the same news and media. We don't have common sources of information. We don't agree on what's factual and what's real. And that's a problem. And I think the splintering of the media is a problem. One thing I think might be interesting if Donald Trump does lose and start this media empire, he may siphon the far, far right off into this Breitbart hybrid, whatever he creates, this American UKIP. And Fox News may wind up being more of the center right. So it may be that we may come to a more common understanding of at least what the GDP is. I mean, I've had arguments with people about the GDP, and it's a number. It's like, you cannot argue with me about this. But people will say, that isn't real. So I think if we can at least start agreeing what's real, we might be able to be a country again.
Joy Reid hosts AM Joy on MSNBC, weekends 10 a.m. to noon, and she's on a lot during the week as an analyst. And her book is called Fracture, Barack Obama, the Clintons, and the Racial Divide, which came out last year. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you. This was so much fun.